This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Where should I even begin to talk about Eileen Miles? I could point out some of the names giving praise on their books, Chris Krauss, John Waters, John Ashbery, Helen MacDonald, and titles include quasi-autobiographical novels like Inferno and Chelsea Girls, the latter of which you might have seen on display here all summer as a summer classic here. There are also numerous poetry collections, and I should say we have a whole bunch of these books still for sale up at the front of the store, in addition to the book I have in my hand, which is why we're all here today. Their new book is called Afterglow, and the first time I saw it, I thought, an Eileen Miles dog memoir? Okay. Feels both right and a little bit odd, because I have certain expectations, maybe it's just me, of standard tropes for animal relationship stories, and Miles's work often tosses standard tropes off to the side. So case in point, in the first few pages, you're already learning about people advocating for the legal rights of dogs against their owners, speculations on what it would be like to work for George W. Bush, and so on. But it's still a very reverent dog memoir about how we develop relationships with creatures, binding souls, whether the creature is dog or human. In this case, a dog named Rosie. And with that, please join me in welcoming Eileen Miles to Politics and Prose.
Hi. Is this on? Yeah, okay, cool. That was great, thank you. So I've just always heard of there being a bookstore with this name, so I'm so happy to read here at last. So, indeed, this is a dog book. Officially started writing it when the dog started dying, which was like in 2006. And so I had a pit bull named Rosie who lived from 1990 till 2006. But as it turns out, there were elements of the book that I'd written before, you know, long before I thought about her dying at all, but more just in terms of like some of what John was talking about. It was just like, if you have a dog, no matter what you do, you're not doing enough for the dog and you feel guilty. So it's very easy to imagine the dog being in a state of rage at you all the time. And so you kind of write into, I wrote into that a little bit, you know, and I'll start with that part. But then after she died, there was a problem, which was then, now what, you know? Because I just didn't want it to be a sentimental, like I meant it to be kind of a punk dog book, in that it was going to be about just about her dying, and it was going to be harrowing. But, you know, she was dying for 6 months, and that was it, and I said what I had to say about it. And the maybe the core joke was God dog, like I kept reversing that and making dog be God and so on. But so it wound up being, but I read a lot of sci-fi when she was dying, which I had read a lot when I was a kid. So it just started to imbue the book, and it just got to be the most fantastic book. You'll see if it's really fantastic, but it's a pretty fantastic book. And so I'm going to read, because this is D.C., I'm going to read one of the, there's a part that's sort of governmental and fantastic. So I'm going to read the beginning and then towards the end. And thank you so much for being here. One day in 1999, an awkward hand-addressed letter appeared in my hallway. The mailman threw everything on the stairs. I grabbed a letter and headed with Rosie to the dog run, which in that neighborhood was a skimpy little triangle at 39th Street west of 9th Ave. It was an amazing perspective on midtown roofs and also dull traffic heading to New Jersey. My neighbors were weird, sad former actors. I liked the pink-cheeked older woman named Doris who walked every one of the neighborhood's dogs, including mine. This is like 16 years ago, so Doris is probably dead. Sitting on a bench while Rosie sniffed the ground, I tore open the strange note. It read, "Dear Eileen, I take the liberty of calling you Eileen to begin the unpleasant duty of forcing you to legally take responsibility for the damages you have inflicted over a period of 9 years upon the being you have taken to calling Rosie. I am Rosie's lawyer. Dog lawyers have only become possible in recent years, even months. Which is not to say crimes of all kinds against dogs are new in any way. Crimes against dogs are ancient and widespread, but dogs having the wherewithal to attain legal representation is new indeed. My services have been retained thanks to a generous bequest by an anonymous donor who set up a foundation in her will for the explicit purpose of identifying dogs who were likely litigants, candidates for beginning the long and arduous process of getting the ball rolling on dogs' rights. It's been clear to my client during her life, and most pressingly at the time of her death, that the best way to make this need known would be to take up an individual dog's case, not the case of all dogs, which is too ubiquitous to pursue in the explicit way the law makes possible for human litigants, who are generally assumed to be individuals. A wealthy individual, of course, does not have more rights than a poor one. We are all brought up to honor human rights, but only wealthy humans are able to use the full force of the law, i.e., obtain high-quality representation. By this logic, there can be no freedom for dogs unless there are wealthy dogs. There is one today, the dog formerly known as Rosie. She has been left a significant sum of money in my client's will. She may spend it as she pleases with the single stipulation that she obtain counsel and press charges against her owner for a variety of abuses and crimes against dog kind. As you know, Eileen Miles, that owner is you. It seemed unbelievable to me. Rosie was about 10. I looked at her licking an empty wrapper against the fence. She appeared entirely innocent of the letter's content. "What? Are we already going home?" she seemed to say. "Okay, I don't think she knows anything about this." I popped the leash back on and walked home, planning my day. The loft we lived in was right across from Port Authority. Day and night, I watched the lights of buses sail in and out of the building. I thought about the letter from time to time. I mean, for years. I showed it to people. They laughed and smiled. Could Rosie and my entire relationship be framed as blame? Did I force her to have sex with Buster that one time? No, twice. Could I write a book about that? I've never been an idea writer. I have like a spurt, and then I go do something else. But this would be her book. A dog book is a great idea. So that's where we begin. And so much, much, much later, I guess when I wrote some of the book at McDowell. I wrote some of the book in San Diego where I was living when she was dying. And then in 2013, I went to Ireland. I got a Guggenheim, and I think all the many decades that I applied for Guggenheim fellowships, I always had it in my mind that if I got a Guggenheim, I would go to Ireland. And so I got one, and so I did. And so I did a lot of like editing of what I had already written of the book in Ireland. But I got to a point where it was very clear that I needed about 35 more pages. The book was not big enough. There was something missing. So I'm sure some of you guys know, one of my favorite writers and friends is Fanny Howe. And she is sort of my predecessor in life. Like always when I get a teaching job, it's because Fanny just left it. And even that we both have Irish citizenship through our families. And so Fanny gave me, I mean, like when I told her I was finally going to go and spent like 6 months in Ireland, she was like, you have to go here, you have to go here, you have to go here. And so one of the heres was a monastery in Limerick called Glenstall Abbey. And she said it was a great place to write, and indeed it really was. And so I was in the abbey, and I wrote like one chapter, and it was good. And I was kind of agonizing slightly. And then I had that sensation that happens sometimes where I really felt like Rosie came to me. And because she does talk a little bit in the book at an earlier point. There's like a talk show, a puppets talk show. Like I had these puppets when I was a child. And when somebody said, well, does Rosie talk in the book? I was like, does Rosie talk? It was like such a McDowell question. I was like, I don't know. And then I thought, under what conditions would she talk? And I thought, well, if my childhood puppets had a talk show and they invited her on as the guest, surely she would talk. And so that was dealt with. And then she didn't talk again for the rest of the book. But in Ireland, I really felt like she spoke. And she was like, okay, we got to finish the book. Get me out of here. I have an idea. It's a tapestry. And I happened to really love tapestries. And I was in the UK. And so I could go over to London to the V&A Museum and see like Henry VIII's tapestries. But basically, Rosie just said, you write. And I'll dictate, you know, you weave basically and basically be her servant, which I felt I was for much of the book. So this is like the, we kind of start in an artist colony in Ireland and then we go to the monastery, but it's Rosie talking, just know that. This somebody got terrified. They thought, dog book, good? No, not dog book, not good. And in Ireland, I should mention that briefly there was a dog. There was a dog that just sort of came to me. You're not supposed to have a dog at an artist colony, but there was this dog, and I kind of let her into my room and had her for a few days, and her name was Peggy. And by the way, Peggy, I'm fairly certain, and bear in mind, this is Rosie talking. And by the way, Peggy, I'm fairly certain, is Nellie. Can that be true? Yes, the dog you so badly wanted, who crawled in your bed, was in fact your paternal grandmother, Nellie O'Riordan. You needed an Irish guide. All the women in the kitchen said you should just take her, because that would be the Irish way. But there's no right way or wrong way, Eileen. I've watched you spend so much time at the crossroads thinking this or that, because of the absence of one very clear and important idea, which I will now share with you. Longing is not direction. It's okay to feel very sad that this dog is not in your life, and you thought she would be. To be a deep and constant well of sadness is a very real thing, but it does not mean that you should go either right or left. It just means you are a well. You need to go on, and especially now you need to go fast, because you want to cover some time and land in the time you've got left. I need to finish this tapestry, be done with your book, and resume my own traveling. Your grandmother entered into Peggy because that's what people do all the time, become dogs. And dogs become human that way, and this transmigration of souls is a very Irish thing, remarked upon persistently in literature. But it's wider than Irish or American, more ancient. And we will continue now with our weaving, which I think you understand now is an intuition, a dog talking inside of your head. Listen closely. And carry this message to the world. I've been other dogs, and I've been people other than your father. I've been Monty. Oh, that's a big idea of the book, is that the dog is Eileen's father, too. I've been Monty. In fact, that's why you keep getting stuck at the crossroads. Your father was stuck, and so he just died, crumpled. But you kind of pause and scribble a bit, or a lot. Your favorite moment in literature is when Frank O'Hara paused. Did he pause? And thought, I could just make a phone call. It was a dog thought. Robert Johnson paused. You once had a car accident listening to Robert Johnson. He is very important for you. He made a deal with the darkness at the crossroads. It is how he got so great. Like lightning hit those fingers. Give it to me, he said to the devil, and that's what he got. He got it by standing there in between and welcoming the darkness in. You think it's evil? It's something else. It's what's in between. Claim it. Own it. You've heard of Manichaeism? It's the struggle between light and dark. It's very empathetic. It's very thoughtful about the pain of the light particles trapped in all things. The light just wants to get out. I'm Mani. I painted my teachings because if you show a story, it's in the day. It's not trapped in the secret place. I mean, you can barely prove what I said, but I had influence. In fact, people generally know more about me as an anti-belief than a belief. That's okay. I take space. I take space over power any day. My pictures had power and traveled all over the world for about 500 years. I was bigger after I was dead, which I think is kind of my way. And I was trapped in a cell, and I died there. What's lost has more power than what is saved, known to be lost. And that tragedy fell within, and was felt within the followers. Your mother received a letter from a woman who was on your father's route, number 411 in Harvard Square, and after he died, she wrote to your mother to say what a wonderful man your father was. Do you remember this story? No need to reply. I'm taking this right to the end, all of it. I'll introduce people. I might sing a song, but I'm taking it home. I am. Here we go. You've thought about that letter so much because your mother lost it. She never gave it a second. It was the way she survived. She stood there wavering on a bit of scar tissue. It was a proud stand. That was her crossroads, and she made a sound, and then she just threw it out. That letter about him, all his letters. He's entirely gone because she needed to keep moving, or she would have spent her whole life at the crossroads. And she built him up as an enormous, invisible man, a letter carrier, a monument, your dad, as someone you needed to see. You have such figures all over your family tree, dogs and letter carriers. Do you know why? I will tell you. To carry the sky. Here we go. There's a particular blue, a kind of vibrating denim that was adopted by the U.S. Postal Service in the early 20th century. And it is technically described as blue mixed cadet cloth. The postal uniform is one of my favorite colors. I Monty, I Rosie, I Terrence. Being illuminated exactly as much and precisely as little as a night sky in winter. In that struggle of night and dark, this is the exact fabric that depicts a frozen moment, a snowflake moment of color and crystallization that all dogs and precisely calibrated spiritual beings would recognize. Visually, there are colors that are also tones. That's the kind of painter Monty was. He uses color sparingly, just a woof of it. I'm not making a dog joke. I'm making a dog joke. It's an Iranian painter term, and I was born in Persia. I spoke Syriac, Aramaic, but let's be frank, Iran. I was an Iranian holy dog. My book of paintings was called The Arzang. Once I was no longer seated on the holy throne in churches because I was dead, the Arzang would be placed there on the highest seat. It was venerated. It was open. I'm telling you this because in our time, you must make a holy book, a book full of holes about time along the shapes that grace this tapestry. Can I be frank again? This rug. And when the dog says rug, the dog means tapestry. It's all one thing. It's a magic rug, and I am a mailman. Your father was a mailman. Your grandmother's brother, Tim O'Riordan from Knocknagowan, Rye Lane, Cork, mailman. On the mile side, your grandfather's younger brother came to be known as Barney from Dunmackenna, Lighton, Monaghan, mailman. It's a shame, Eileen, that you are not a mailman. The dog smiles. Perhaps you are. But the United States, as we know, is a very evil and accidentally spiritual country. It is a Manichaean country. So accidentally, pyramids speak on its money, and so accidentally, the cadet blue of Persia, a vibrating speaking color, is the uniform of the common U.S. mailman. And your father Terence was one. Terence meaning tender. It's no accident. Am I still rosy? Perhaps you should go out and look out the window and see the mixed cadet blue sky. It's a magical time and a thief's time. It's little wonder that mailmen worldwide do not simply destroy the mail. In the same way that a chorus of dogs will surely defile and piss on this rug when we are done, the mailman wants nothing better than to destroy the mail. Why? All these men and women who are carrying these bags and carriages through the streets of the world, all of them are dogs. Does this not give you a different and a better feeling about the U.S. Postal Service? It was enough for you to learn that there have been mailmen going back in your family's history for as long as there was mail, as long as there was writing. The sky is full of pictures tonight. Cadet blue is made up of millions of pinpoints of light coming through from the other side. Other side of what, you might ask? The holes in the tapestry and the holes in the sky are of the same ilk. It is for the purpose of reproduction. Now, of course, there is not just one night like tonight. It has a copy, and that has a copy. It is out there somewhere. The universe is doubled. I, Mani, was given prophecy by my twin. Also, if you look long at the double sky, the double universe posing as one establishes a massaging effect on your optic nerve, which will open a sea of images, which is destiny and time. It is open tonight, and tonight, the night after Christmas, all the messages that were ever sent will ever be sent are written in the sky. Why are the postal workers angry? It is not enough to know that they are dogs. Just last night, I was told, on Christmas, of all time, a sad tale. Of course, Christmas is the saddest day of all for me, because Jesus was my other. What day was Monty born? We do not know. No copy of his book, The Arzang, exists. We hope this book will be that copy. We know that it sat on a chair, and it was revered. The dogs who work for the U.S. Postal Service are sending false messages, and it breaks their hearts. The sad story I heard last night was that a dog outside of the service had been killed, had been put down for biting a mailman. This is a slow religious war. The dogs who have taken the bodies of mailmen, either from birth or after the time of the age of 13, when a body of one with a weak nature may be intuited, are the natural prey of the dogs in body who are loyal to the picture, not the script. You would think then that dogs would hate writers, but it is not so. Each writer is required to tell a dog story, and so dogs attach themselves to writers to spur on the ghostwriting. And a writer might worry that too many dog books are being written, and no one will be interested in reading hers and buying it. And obviously, Mary Oliver has written a dog book. Writing a dog book is hard because the writer is in servitude to the dog, most clearly now. The dog has been serving the writer for years, opening up her life and getting her out into the air and onto the beaches and even bringing attractive people into the unattractive life of the writer who often never goes out. do a tiny jump. I want to return to the mailman and the letter. What is a letter, Eileen? As your father is floating over the house and the child with curly hair, with a perm, huh, is agonizingly writing these words, I will not talk in the corridors, I will not talk in the corridors. You are beginning your weaving, Eileen. Gertrude Stein is a very great weaver. All writers who use the sonic mode in writing are returning the fruits to the cave. We watched you smash a red clay pineapple one day in your farmhouse in Ireland, Eileen. I hope by now you would see the meaning of it. In your wind-swept 18th century summer, 2013, in Italy and Ireland, the pineapple was following you. The pineapple is Ganesh. Imani brought Ganesh into not Christianity or whatever you call the thing I was glowing in. Jesus was one ball and Imani was the other. Jesus was my brother. The pineapple, of course, is a gift. Why were you so hurriedly moving the pineapple off the windowsill one day in Ireland? Getting ready to go again, I think. Once upon a time, pineapples adorned your brother's bedposts. Your brother was wealthy, Eileen. It seemed that way to you as a child because he had a paper route. You do not need a man's wealth. Mani does not need Jesus Christ's fame. People say the pineapple means welcome, but it also screams Rish. Grown elsewhere, brought here by magic, the pineapple is a voluminous kind of mail. It will always be delivered. The mail will find you. Whose house are you in now, Eileen? No matter. I think you linked your fate to the road in that shattered moment. You broke finally with history in its satisfied welcome. There is only comfort now in working slowly with me and all the dogs, tracing a path like a Johnny Appleseed of blue fruits and sonorities across the sky. But what is it about letters? Because we want to tell the truth at last and not spread the same stale jokes about dogs and mailmen. You have mailmen in your family, and they were dogs, and all mailmen are dogs, some born and some late intuited. We call them impregnated mailmen. Letters are the cave turned inside out. Letters are the magic hidden. Am I against writing? Am I against the text? I am against the pineapple smash. I did it. And I am against the letter, too. When they say he goes postal, he is exploding from the pressure of carrying the letter for years. Often he is a soldier. Sometimes they are women, too. In fact, the post office is the single greatest employer of women in the U.S. government. Women quickly shinny up this pole of power. The pressure of the letter is great. The last great thing about letter writing was cursive, and it is gone. Cursive was a photograph of the nerves of the writer. So though the load of the letter was great, the flying hand, like a bird, told the inside of the cave of the writer. It is abstracted stuff. The pressure of the light particles is great inside matter. Imagine when there are no pictures. Each letter rolls in front of a cave and shuts out the light. What else does it do? The last great thing was the typewritten letter. The weight of the body on the tap, tap, tapping machine, the choice of paper, usually the hand has written the address on the outside of the envelope. Often the body has moistened the stamp and has stuck it on. Less involved, we tear a piece away and we stick it on now. Possibly a hair may get caught in the pressure of that. A dirty person will leave something, if not spit. But how is the mailman against the letter itself? He carries the world, women too. The post office is the most gender-neutral division of the U.S. government. She carries the compacted dreams. The language implodes each time. I have sent her 36 letters of my love towards the end of a century. My wildest love never before offered in print. I wrote it carefully on light blue paper in India. In another year or two, in a fit of rage, I sent all her letters back. And she burned them all, she said. Did she? My love and hers commingled in a pile of ash in her driveway. Another time a man took all of my young poet letters I wrote him in the 80s and piled them in his sink and burned them. These people are sad demons, lovers turned unlovers. These tragedies released the news from itself, and somewhere a postal worker's burden was lightened. The letter does not stop. You write a letter and it goes somewhere and somebody reads it and the letter goes back and forth multitudinously. A letter will never die. It must be burned, I say, to be returned to light. The post office needs to walk in the blue uniform of time, the mixed cadet, and be seen knowing your messages are being sent by his footsteps and by your thought the ancient method. Dogs should wander freely, and so should the postal workers. FedEx is evil because it is faster. The post office could be faster still in the Neanderthal way of no trace, not the toxic electronic light of the internet. What is the internet? The observed letter, the unprivate mind. The mind will be open soon enough. The white man came in the middle of the night and clubbed and axed the children and the women to death. He is not worth the dogs he has working and living with him. Each wounded space should hold a party, and it will. A letter is like a dream of a thought. We mourn the loss of the letter, but dogs mourn the loss of the thought. The postal uniforms should grow softer, longer, and looser, more like tunics. And the post offices could each be decorated by a tapestry such as this, made by idle postal women and men, no longer on a particular route, but wandering aimlessly, being the beautiful letters of our time. To be a season of postal workers wandering in their lightweight, gossamer, mixed cadet blue shirts and pants and gowns. In the winter, the fine blue wool coats reflecting the sky, and when a snowflake falls on the arm of a postal worker, he will stop and smile and gesture to all around him, and they will look at what has landed on him and what is falling in the skies, because he is a dog, and dogs love snow. There is no burden anymore. Neither snow, nor sleet, nor rain shall be considered anything but colors and not problems at all. What the sky is doing that I am continuous with, and look at what has fallen on my arm. The hats of the worker will grow lush, wide-brimmed in summer, and flowers and fruits beginning to grow off them, and in winter the tall feathers to communicate with the birds flying south or staying around. Slowly the hats will fall and drape the bodies of the postal workers, and the clothes will begin to fall away, and the hair will grow wild and curly. The women will be models for all of the other humans, wild, strong, mammalian women of the U.S. Postal Service, carrying nothing but a strong and passionate attitude and a message for everyone, which is their own bouncing back and forth among them all for eternity or infinity or today. Time in the hands of the postal worker will become slowly unlabeled. FedEx and UPS will continue rushing around, but increasingly they will not be carrying anything except speed itself. And eventually they'll begin bumping into each other, and only each other, because the proper refuge will have occurred, and everyone will be beginning to live slowly in the right time with themselves, because there is no kingdom now, and the end is only when the road has invited us to leave. Are we ready? Thank you. Any questions?
Well, I'll start things off for people, and hopefully other people will ask questions as well. But you talked a little bit. I was going to ask about handwriting, and you ended up talking about it in the passage that you read. Because I know in your writing a lot of the time you use underlines, which usually don't end up in a lot of other books. Like
right.
When you're writing, people underline when they want to emphasize something that ends up getting into italics when
right.
you're reading a book. And could you talk about the process of, I don't know, it just ends up looking like handwriting when you read it.
Right.
And
right.
I just like that about your work. So I was wondering if you could talk about that. It's a small thing. But
yeah. I mean, I think there's so many ways in which writing is disembodying, you know, and so I feel like part of what I've always wanted to do in writing is to figure out how to put the body back. And I think there's so many different ways of doing that. But certainly, like, as somebody who, like, started writing by hand and in notebooks and then was the manual typewriter and the electric typewriter and the dedicated word processor and the computer, there's been so many different levels of publication and watching my work get slower, further and further abstracted. So I think Alice Notley, I noticed, was using underline. Like, I've always hated, like, I think underlines, because I grew up on comic books too, so a lot of my graphic ideas have to do with when somebody was like, what do you mean? And in a comic book, mean was always underlined. And when I would, you know, so in poetry magazines, that was the first step, but then quickly people, you know, like, it became, you know, like, underline means italics. And it didn't. It meant underline, you know, and italics meant italics, which meant something else for me. And so I think it's, in the same way that, like, the longer I've read, the more I've become sort of a crazy reader, and I'm moving my body and moving my arms because I feel like I have permission to use everything I've got to convey what I'm trying to do. I've also felt like in the printed word, taking permission to put things back that I missed along the way and thought, well, wait a second, this might be bad English, but it is actually the way I hear it and the way I think it, and is one of the codes that I've learned to think and grow knowledge in. You know, so I think that, you know, like, I think figuring out ways to put handwriting back into the present of a book is very exciting to me. And any kind of de-standardizing way to treat the language is very exciting, because again, it's like, it's just one more way that we get homogenized, you know. It's sort of so it's like difference, it's the excitement of difference, you know, and that's a difference that I care about. Great. Making it graphic, I think, is one way of saying it. Please.
Great. Well, thank you for the reading. I first met you or saw you read I guess here in Washington, uh-huh. But it was when Washington still had a women's bookstore, and it was about 17 years ago.
It wasn't Lambda Bookstore, or there was a women's bookstore?
Yeah. Llamas. Yeah, thank you. Huh. And you were traveling with Sister Spit?
Yes. So, 96.
Oh, was it? Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Okay, so before 2000. So it's great to see you now and reading and, like, reading out loud, and it looks like you enjoy the still reading out loud and
sure.
performing. And I'm just wondering, like, how do you feel? Are you still doing spoken word at all? Or
I never did spoken word. I don't even know what spoken word
means. No, you were reading your poetry, I guess, at that time, right?
When you you mean like reciting?
Yeah, reciting.
Memorizing.
Ah.
Yes. No, I don't do. I mean, like, once I keep thinking that would be great. Wouldn't I should do that? Why don't I do that? You know, because it was a sort of a step. And it was also about the 80s, because it seemed like I started writing poetry in the 70s, and poetry was really cool. Mm-hmm. And it was poetry and rock and roll, and it was just like it was in the culture. And by the 80s, you know, it was just, you know, like the 80s was so about money and drugs and fiction and wealth. You know, it's just like my neighborhood changed. Mm. And so it was suddenly like to be a poet was sort of to be a loser. and you know, and I mean, I had interests in writing fiction then too, but I was a poet, and I love writing poetry. And performance art was having a real heyday in the 80s. And so for me, I think two things. One was that I had always heard that Russian poets, you know, like Mayakovsky, they would like learn their poems and recite, and they were like rock stars, and they had stadiums. Mm-hmm. So there was just this way in which if you put the text into your body, again, you know, then you would become it more. But also in the world of performance art, people would not reject you as a poet. They would see you as a performance artist. And so then you had an opportunity to, because I think, like, again, we're talking about money. Like in the 70s, there was the NEA was funded fairly well. And the literature department, the literature division was started by a guy who was all about the small press publishing. And so there was like there was money for touring for poets even in the 70s. By the 80s, there was no money like that, but there was money for performance art because art galleries would bring you. And so part of it for me always has been trying to figure out how to get my work out, you know. And if I have to memorize it, I'll do that, you know. And now I don't have to memorize it, so yeah. I keep thinking what a great idea, but I never do it.
And are you working on anything now after the publication of this book?
A screenplay of Chelsea Girls. So we'll see. You know, it's like you sign something and it goes this far, and then you write something and it goes this far, and it's just like, you know, but it's a movie. Yeah. So will it happen? I don't know. But I, you know, they optioned it and I got signed on as the writer. So I'm half the way. Thank you. Yeah. Hello.
Hello, Eileen. Thanks so much for that. I'm thinking about a lot of the ways that one thinks of a dog book is, you know, cutesy and anthropomorphism and projection, right? Mm-hmm. And you're playing around with projection, but it also seems like possession, both in the sense of the dog possessing you and sort of the dynamics of ownership. And I wondered if there's anything, you know, in your thinking about that kind of changed through the doing of it, how sort of playing around with possession possessed you, perhaps. And especially sort of the economic, you know, sort of the possession as ownership, right?
Huh. Wow. There's so much in there. I mean, I feel like she just taught me how to write fiction through, you know, because I felt like I was like, okay, I'm going to speak for the dog. And I was sort of open to that. And then somebody else started to talk in the book. And suddenly other people started to talk in the book. So it was kind of like, in a way, it was like, it was exactly the, you know, watch out what you what you ask for. Because I was, being open to the dog, I wound up being open to a lot more. You know, so even when I'm reading this, I mean, like, I'm being the dog, but I feel like there's this preacher character walking through this book. And I feel like she's like one of those, like, Amy Simple, you know, like one of those female kind of cult leader preachers. I was like, I don't know where she, I mean, I have some ideas about where she came from. Like when I was younger and I would try and stop taking drugs and drinking so much, I would go into these like chilling out periods and I would get spiritual. And what that would mean was there was like a spiritual bookstore or an occult bookstore in New York in the 80s and 90s called Wiser's. And they had all these theosophical texts. And I always knew that poets were supposed to be, like, Yeats was into Theosophy and Madame Blavatsky and all these characters. So I would read these crazy books, you know, and they would just spin these other worlds. And, you know, the thing that's so weird about the things you read is that, where does it go? You know, like, what happened to all that knowledge and information? You know, it's like something on some cellular level was memorizing it, you know, and like all that crazy stuff came out in this book. You know, I was like, whoa, you know, and I was like, no, it was like I did the homework. It's just that I had to wait for 30 or 40 years. So that doesn't exactly answer your question, but she gave me a voice. And suddenly, because I think the joke is, too, that this is a memoir, you know, and people are always like, in my novels, because my narrator is Eileen Miles, people are like, it's a memoir, you know. Miles thinks she's writing a novel. It's a memoir, you know. So this time I call it a memoir, but it really is fiction. Yeah, there's so much more. I mean, I didn't make up the dog, but I made up the book, you know.
I'd love to ask one more question, but I don't want to impinge on anybody else. I just, you talked about the sci-fi that you were reading. What books were you reading?
Octavia Butler. I mean, it kind of, what's her name? The other, Ursula Le Guin. And then William Gibson. And then some, like, very old school Robert Heinlein, and a guy named Ben Bova, who because I grew up in this town in Massachusetts, and there was a sci-fi writer in my town named Ben Bova. And I was just always like, oh my God, there's a writer that lives in Arlington, you know? And so I just, what happened was I went to the library sale in San Diego, and they were just getting rid of all the sci-fi, you know, or the paperback. And so I just bought a ton of the stuff, and it just happened to be what I was reading when the dog was dying. But the thing is, you know, even being female, it's sort of like you were like, you like sci-fi, then you have to read Octavia Butler. And I'm like, I don't have to read female sci-fi writers just because I'm female. Like people, you know, everything winds up feeling like this kind of control or this rebellion. But to finally get around to Octavia Butler and Ursula Le Guin was like life changing, and you know, and there's so much. I mean, I just stole plots, but I'm pretty open about it. Like I was like, how do I write sci-fi? I who have no idea of how to write sci-fi, even though I've read tons of it. And so what I started to do, it's like this trick that I learned from Bob Dylan, because when Bob Dylan was going to see Woody Guthrie when Woody Guthrie was dying. He was just, you know, like he was a total hero of Woody Guthrie's. And then he would go to some club on Bleecker Street and say, here's a song by Woody Guthrie. And he would sing Woody songs. And after a while, he was really writing his own songs, but he kept pretending that he was covering Woody, you know. And he did that for a long time before he claimed those as Bob Dylan songs. And so with this, I was like, I started to tell the stories of the books I was reading when my dog was dying, except I'm really I have a bad memory. I really can't repeat plots at all. I forget them utterly. And so I just started repeating and lying. So it's sort of like I kind of appropriated Ursula Le Guin and Octavia Butler and then just infused it with my own stuff. So it's like, it's kind of like Kathy Acker sci-fi. It's like pastiche. Can we have a Buddhist moment in case there's another question? Like I can handle a little.
I have one.
Oh, good.
Yeah, Thanks for the reading. It was great.
You're welcome.
And I can't believe that I haven't read the book, so I can't believe you combined Rosie and the U.S. Mail, which are just two things I adore. So that's great.
You wouldn't happen to be a DAP, i.e., daughter of an American postal worker, would you be?
No. A labor person.
We started this group in the 90s.
Yeah. What? No, a labor person. So I get, I
labor.
Thought about it. But
yeah.
The question I have is not about that. The question is about, somewhat about Rosie, but sort of I've thought a lot about having, Rosie was in your life for 16 years, right?
Right.
Is that how many years? So how, and you said you talked, it was sort of about her dying, but how did that 16-year period affect the voice of Rosie? I mean, do you know? Did you think about that? I mean, because she was a chunk of time.
Right. So it was a relationship.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that's so peculiar about a relationship with an animal is it in so many ways it's not that different between a relationship with a lover or the relationship you had in your family, mm-hmm. which is that you have language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you start these jokes and then the jokes continue. Like I got her when I was 40 years old. I finally realized I was like old enough and I'd stopped drinking. I was like, I could have a dog. I'm an adult. I can do this, you know? And so I get this dog and then I look into her eyes and it's my father. I mean, I just had this feeling like nobody ever looked at me like that before. It's Dad, you know, and I love my dad, and he died when I was a kid. And it was just like my joke was always that yeah, of course he would come back to be my dog. Of course he would do that. He was a funny guy, you know. But it's all like, but I then embroidered the joke for 16 or 17 years, you know, both with her, on her, and through her. You know, and so I think the thing it was just like having a relationship, and also the part about the lawyer has to do with the guilt, mm-hmm. and so I just was writing her guilty, you know, her guilty complaint to me for 16 or 17 years. I mean, a lot of it was just fuck you, Eileen, you know, because you would take, you know, there'll be some event, and I realized I had to take my dog out, and I would like run out and drag her up the stairs, my little apartment building, you know, like 10-minute walk, and she just was this pit bull face coming up the stairs behind me looking really furious, and that would be the fuck you Eileen. But it became more ornate than that too, so it was the love. The love is always, I mean, I think that's the thing. It's so when you break up with somebody, you're like, where do all those jokes go? Where does that whole weird, you know? And the same with that's where this went, you know. This is like family language.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Do you have a new dog?
I do. I have Honey, a golden pit bull. And it was total accident because I was like, there were dogs in between. There was two Chihuahua cattle dogs that I had with a girlfriend. And then we broke up and she got the dogs. So I was doing alternate parking in New York. I don't know if you have this in D.C., where you sit in your car and you meet your neighbors, basically. It's so weird. And my dog walker comes along and she's, you know, and we catch each other up about breakup and who got the dogs. And so she's like, you're dogless. And I said, yes. And she goes, you know, there's a pit rescue person on the block who would be very, she goes, you could foster. And I was like, oh, that sounds perfect. Foster. I could do that. So she hooked me up with this person who like texted me like instantly. And there was like a little submissive pit bull named Mindy. That I could have for the weekend. And on Monday, somebody was taking Mindy. So it was very clear, very boundaried. I'm like, this is perfect. And then on Friday, I get an email. And it's like from the dog rescue person saying, wait a second. There's a beautiful golden pit bull named Honey in the city shelter. And she's being put down at 1:00. She's 2 years old. And look at her. And I looked at her. And it was like, you know, you can tell so much. I mean, if you guys go to Pet Finder, you can tell. You can tell so much by looking in that dog's eyes, you know, and this is a dog I would not have taken. You know, she just had this mad, glittering look, like just fear, raging for life, you know, like crazy redhead. And I was like, all right. And she said, you don't have to, we'll just foster her just to get her out of the shelter and we'll figure it out later. So that's my dog, you know, just like 3 years have passed. And she's just, you know, like I feel like there are human dogs and there are animal dogs. And Rosie was a human and Honey is an animal. And she just like, she went when I live in Texas and New York, and she went to a few days before I left Texas, I took her for a walk and I was in the middle of a deadline. I felt guilty. I hadn't taken her out. We're walking down this beautiful road with like ranch land on both sides and she's pulling and I'm like, let her be free. So I let go of her. She quickly runs over to the side of the road, finds a hole, and is out on the ranch land, and there's cattle out there. And I was like, oh, no. And this has happened once before, and she starts herding them, you know? And she was gone for an hour and a half the last time. And I'm like, I know the drill. And I just went to this, you know, the road, waited. And she didn't come back. She was gone for 4 days. And I met ranchers. I met animal control. I met border control. I met librarians. A friend of mine who's like a ranger went in a little plane looking for honey. And then, like, as I'm driving out of town, and I had a dog sitter coming, but there was no dog, I get a call. I'm halfway to the airport, and they're like, we found honey in the barn with the cattle. And she had been out there herding bulls for, like, 4 days. They were like, the ranchers kept seeing this dog. I was like, this little pit bull. I was like, what was she? So my joke now is, I mean, like, I felt like I got a house in Texas for honey. And then I had to get a Prius because it's like, it's so expensive to drive across America that I needed to get a car that you wouldn't use much gas. But now it seems like I need ranch land and some cattle. So she just keeps upping the scale of my life. You know. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you. Hey.
Please. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Have time for another question?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I was wondering, you were talking about giving voice to Rosie and just the concept of giving voice. And I was happened to be starting to read your book. I haven't finished it yet, this one, when I saw an article about a lawyer who was fighting for, I think, the Colorado River, I can't remember which, and saying if corporations are people and have legal rights, why not a river? And these arguments have been made for primates, and it also got me thinking about Ted Chiang. I don't know if you've read his book, a sci-fi writer, about sort of software avatars and their eventual legal rights of some kind. So I thought it was interesting you opened the book with a legal discussion and how legal language and a legal framework can give voice to subjects under the law or whatever, and that the dog might be one. And I'm just wondering, in terms of legal writing versus the kind of writing you do, if you think of it outside of Rosie's memoir, of giving voice to, or giving voice to yourself or others, or how that works.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we all have these other lives, and it's so, like, I always secretly wished I was a lawyer, because I think it's so interesting that it's language. Except it's sort of like language that doesn't change, but changes the world. Whereas I think of, you know, what I do with writing that I love is it changes, you know, and then does it change the world? I mean, I think it does too, but that's not necessarily its job. Its job is to be alive and to change. But I wonder, were you suggesting that the river has rights?
Well, I think so.
That's like the most sexy thought I've ever heard of.
The right to exist.
Why can't a river be something that's... Absolutely. I mean, I'm starting to move towards vegetarian because suddenly the reality of what animals are and what they feel, it's like, so, you know, it's like, I'm a big bacon eater. And suddenly I was like, I've heard so much that pigs have the intelligence of a 5-year-old kid. So it's just like, maybe next time I think about having some bacon, I think, why don't I think about having a 5-year-old kid? You know, if it's not, you know, think about that, you know? So it was like, it was horrible to leave it in my hotel. I'd left the bacon in the street, you know, in the hallway. But I thought, I'm not going to eat that child. No. No. Oh, thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.